This week, we look at the character of Enoch, the man, the archetype, the Metatron. In a candid conversation about a recent presentation that Worshipful Brother Darren A. Laners has put together and has given on several occasions, we dive into the topic of Enoch, his vault, and all things mystical. Stick around.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. In the news, just want to mention that we had an amazing time at the MasonicCon South event. It was incredibly amazing. The lectures were wonderful, and the festive board was just so great. We got to meet new friends, hang out with old friends, and just the amazing hospitality of Greensboro Masonic Temple, as well as everything that Brother Matthew Parker put together for this incredible event. It was just so awesome, and I want to give him a huge shout out. And there's a lot of folks out there who put on these big MasonicCon national type events. They are national, even though they pull a large regional audience, but people come from all over to come to these events. And there's a select few people who have been able to do this and do it successfully and come out the other side sane. Of course, people like Brian Simmons and Ritmore and his partners down in Texas, and of course Dago Rodriguez, Joe Martinez, and Alex Power. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, but what an incredible event. And they are going to do it next year, so I do sincerely hope that in the future, next year, you put some time on your calendar for likely the October time frame, perhaps, for MasonicCon South, probably happening again in North Carolina. At the end of this month, I'll be doing the Fall Festive Board at Edmund Lodge number 37, as well as a talk at the Guthrie, Oklahoma, Ancient Accepted Scottish Rite, Southern Jurisdiction Reunion. I'll be doing a talk on the Tetragrammaton, I believe at 3 o'clock on Saturday. And then that evening, on the 29th, I will be giving a talk at the festive board for Veritas Lodge, number 556. I'll try to get all these details up on the website ASAP so that you can check out where you can go for tickets and event information and what those topics will be. As of right now, the Fall Festive Board for Edmund Lodge, number 37, I'll be doing Freemasonry, A History of Mystery. Then 3 o'clock the next day at the Valley Reunion, I'll be doing, again, the Tetragrammaton at 3 o'clock. And then that evening at a festive board for Veritas Lodge, and I believe I'll be doing Quantum Entanglement and Apotheosis. And then, of course, in November, I'll be heading off to the Valley of Spartanburg, Orient of South Carolina, in the Ancient Accepted Scottish Rite, Southern Jurisdiction. I'll be doing a talk down there on Colonial Freemasonry. And a week after that, I'll be doing a Zoom for Lakeside Lodge. So the schedule is filling up fast. We've got things happening all the time. But certainly, November and October are very busy months. For October is probably the busiest month for me every year, just because of annual sessions for Illinois as well. But enough with all that. I've got a great conversation / interview that we did with my good friend and incredible brother, my cohort in probably no less than five large projects all the time. He is my boss for the Grand Royal Arch Education Committee. He is my cohort on the Grand Lodge of the State of Illinois Education Committee. He is my co-editor for the Lyceum. We worked together for years on the Midnight Freemasons. He is the managing editor at the Midnight Freemasons today. I have fully retired from that role, and he is the man in charge over there. And he's also the host of the Meet, Act, and Part podcast, as well as a co-host and co-creator of a podcast with me called Beyond the Fourth Veil, whenever we decide to do episodes. Busy schedules, right? So let's get right into this awesome conversation that you guys are not going to want to miss. Let's check it out. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show this week. We've got special guest, area education officer and a good friend of the WCY podcast, as well as the creator and host of the Meet, Act, and Part podcast, worshipful brother Darren A. Laners. Good to be with you.
Thanks for having me, Robert. Appreciate the opportunity to come on here.
So one of the reasons we've got you on this week is to talk a little bit about one of the presentations that you give that just sounded so fascinating to me. Over the years, I've covered a lot of the different, I guess, mythologies as they exist in and around this idea of Solomon's Temple, as well as legends abounding about Enoch and the pillars. Now, there was probably a period in the podcast several years ago where every week I had some little thing about the pillars that was happening because it was so fascinating to me. I would hear these legends about Egyptian pyramids and the underworld, and then I would hear about descendants of Moses discovering these pillars that then are later made again by Hiram of the Solomonic legend in Freemasonry. But it was all so fantastic and magical and interesting. And every time I read about it, I just felt like it was Indiana Jones all over again. And so I was hoping that you could get us started a little bit and to talk a little bit about what your research has been on this and give us the rundown.
Yeah. So I think some of our interests into Enoch and the pillars and the whole idea that the vault of Enoch were similar. If you look at the high degrees of Freemasonry, especially the Royal Arch degree and the 13th degree, and then almost, I think, probably all the cryptic degrees, they all have this idea of this hidden underground vault. And in the Scottish Rite, it is directly referred to as being the Vault of Enoch and the Royal Arch degree. It's a hidden vault that's found in the rubble of the Temple of Solomon. But interestingly enough, once you know you start kind of tracing this, you find this idea of this legend that Enoch had gotten instructions from God when he was brought up to heaven to build this underground vault, and underneath the ninth vault, place a marble pedestal with a golden delta with the initials of his name upon it, his ineffable name. And then you also learn of Enoch and his two pillars, the pillars he built, one to hold the liberal arts and sciences and the science of speculative masonry, as well as the other pillar, which had hieroglyphic directions to the location of his underground vault should it be lost in this coming disaster. And Enoch had built these pillars to withstand both a great fire and a great flood. So you have also this idea communicated in the Book of Enoch that, you know, God warns Enoch of this impending deluge, and that's how it gets passed down to his son, who is Noah's father. Enoch is Noah's grandfather, I believe, or great-grandfather. And he passes this information down essentially through his family, and then you trace it directly to Noah, who gets the instructions to build this ark to survive this deluge that is going to occur. But the Book of Enoch obviously is pretty wild, and I think we've always seen at least one Enoch as this way of expanding upon what is talked about in Genesis, especially the, you know, where they kind of brush over this idea of these angels that come down and mate with the women, which they find beautiful, and they create these hybrid creatures that are called the Nephilim, or also the Anakim, which if you want to get ancient alienese, you could maybe potentially connect to the Anunnaki, which, the Sumerians talk about. And so there's just a bunch of just crazy, wonderful things to look at when it comes to Enoch.
I find the idea of Enoch, just fascinating, because he's like the only one who, so there's like a couple people in the whole world who never died, right? So it's like Enoch.
Right.
And
Elijah.
Elijah.
And then, obviously, Christ. And then in the Roman Catholic tradition, Mary also ascended into heaven. So you've got four, essentially.
Yeah, four people who have been called up. And in the Old Testament in particular, really, it's just Elijah and Enoch. Enoch who gets called up. I've seen these depictions, right, where Enoch is getting the word passed to him in his ear and communicated to him while he slept so that, you know, it wouldn't kill him. And then he's surrounded by the seven angels, one for each of the liberal arts and sciences. And then you start making all these interesting connections to various other, what you might call world religions or mythologies that deal right. with the same archetype, a character who is taught by the seven something. Yeah. And it's very interesting. The central character of Enoch and maybe even other characters within Freemasonry might form the basis of an archetype of a sort. I mean, who's to say in the way that Hermes and Thoth come together to form a single deity in Rome, in the same respect that over time the Judeo-Christian kind of mythology blends together certain central characters to come up with something like Enoch, or maybe even forgotten characters that go back even farther that we know the Judeo-Christian narrative, in particular the flood myths, are retellings of Sumerian tales. What got you started with Enoch? Usually there's supposed to be nine vaults, but where do the pillars come in with the vaults?
So the pillars, essentially, as I had stated, were made, first of all, one of them was specifically to give the location of the vault should some disaster, world-ending disaster, strike mankind, so that essentially the ineffable name of God would not be lost. So I think that the pillars essentially were built twofold, one being that one pillar gave the location of the vault, which held the ineffable name of God, so that God's name would not be lost, given some calamity that was, foretold to Enoch. And then secondly, to hold this pre-flood knowledge of the liberal arts and sciences and Masonry in particular, as us as Freemasons would like to think that Freemasonry is that ancient. So I do believe that if you were a wise man, which Enoch most definitely was, and you had this foreknowledge of some disaster coming, that one would try to keep some repository of the knowledge that has been accumulated by humankind somewhere. And in this particular case, I guess Enoch felt it safest in a hollow pillar that was to withstand either fire or flood.
And that's not totally crazy. I mean, when we think about how to preserve things today, certainly, these are the things that really would stand the test of time. We keep time capsules. When a lot of people get their charter for a lodge, you know, it's in a tube or whatever, sealed. That kind of idea as an archive of a sort is pretty interesting. When we think about, you know, what could this thing contain? Perhaps a substantial portion of knowledge that may have been lost at the Library of Alexandria, or, you know, who knows? But this idea is just not that strange to me, considering today we've got these seed vaults that we keep that are basically concrete shelters built into the sides of mountains that hold seeds. There is supposedly an archive behind Mount Rushmore that has hard copies of all kinds of things that we would then use to research and to bring us out of an age of chaos, perhaps, if everything had been lost. But what is interesting also is when we think about how we preserve things today, like, you know, we went from writing it on stone to engraving it in metal and stone to books to electronic means. And if something cataclysmic happens, we're not going to be able to read these things that come off of a flash drive or reverse engineer. Like, I highly doubt we will be able to think along the same lines that will allow us to get to a point where we create the same technology we had in the time before. This kind of thing is just bizarre to me. But then we look at something like pyramids all over the world, hieroglyphics that are stored within these pyramids and the clay tablets of Sumerians, the things that did survive, arguably the oldest things, have all been in stone and repositories and to guard against. Of course, we talk about in the second degree lecture, conflagration and inundation, meaning fire and flood. One of the things that I had read at some point when I was researching, in fact, just for the last episode, Hermes Trismegistus, is that he's Hermes the thrice great. And at some point, he's thrice great because he's an amalgamation of a few different people. He is loosely connected to the pillars as well, just like Thoth is supposed to have this emerald tablet, right? Which is very much the same thing. It's the same story, except it's not a pillar. It's a tablet of stone, emerald stone, that has all of the knowledge on it. But it's supposed to be, you know, Hermes of the Greek. Then you've got Thoth of the Egyptians, and then a third character, which, you know, in some instances has been called Noah.
In my research, I found similar, but instead of Noah, I found that Enoch was actually the one that was connected to both Thoth and Hermes Trismegistus. So, but I think it's along the same line. You have this idea of this, for lack of a better term, I'll say a prophet or a prophetic person, somebody who has this insight or wisdom either given to them, as Enoch claims, by God, or as the others also kind of were divinely inspired as well. And Thoth actually, I believe, is a Egyptian deity. I mean, you've got that deification happening there as well. And I think you kind of see similar with Enoch, as, you know, there are three books of Enoch, and the story kind of gets, in the third book of Enoch, I believe, the story gets told about how Enoch becomes the chief of the archangels. Also, for those who are Roman Catholic or are familiar with the angel Metatron, is essentially the messenger of God. He is the one who hears God's orders and then deciphers them and gives them all, gives those, passes those on to all the archangels, who then pass them to the angels. So you have this kind of intermediary between the archangels and God itself.
The name that you said caught out a little bit, but you said it was Metatron?
Correct, Metatron.
So then when we've got this legend of Enoch, time moves forward, right, in terms of the biblical legends and mythologies, right? There are some real deal facts regarding the historical Solomon, the historical David, and those don't generally jive with anything that we have in the traditional mythologies within the Holy Bible and the Pentateuch and all of these holy rites, writs, I should say. But there is a connection that you seem to have made in connecting what Enoch, who he was, what he did, what he built, along with Solomon, the builder of the first temple.
Yeah, so legend essentially states that when Solomon was building the temple, he happened upon this vault of Enoch, and that this particular vault became more developed, if you will, and Solomon used it as a repository to store the ark and other of the treasures of his kingdom within the Temple of Solomon, underneath the Holy of Holies, in case of invasion, disaster, so on and so forth. So you have this direct connection in some of these rabbinical legends and such, where you have Solomon essentially during the construction of laying the foundation of his temple, finding the particular vault, and then it being either adapted or Solomon mimicking his vault underneath the Holy of Holies upon the vault of Enoch.
And this is kind of where we go with the 13th degree, the rediscovery of the word, But it's not necessarily, you know, when we talk about these degrees, there's probably going to be some dudes who are, you know, listening and they're like, oh, you're giving away the degree, the secrets and whatever. Well, listen, these are biblical stories. Freemasonry doesn't hold the patent on a biblical story. So going beyond this idea and really talking about it, you know, there's several craftsmen who are said to have gone down and they keep going down. They come back up and one of them comes back up with the Delta. And he shows the Delta, but they don't know how to pronounce the name. So there's all this lore about this thing. And then the further you go along in some of the other degrees, it becomes kind of interesting, right? I was never clear. So I'm hoping in your opinion you can give on this. Do you think that Solomon recreated what they uncovered or did he repurpose the existing vault?
Well, it's interesting because there are several legends around this vault of Enoch/Solomon. So you have, as I mentioned, the rabbinical legend where Solomon has this, is parallels Enoch, where he has this prophetic vision of the Babylonian destruction of the temple. He orders a vault under the Holy of Holies. This vault is a cubical stone where the ark is placed. And Islamic tradition says that this is actually the stone upon which Abraham attempted to sacrifice Isaac, and that this vault is going to be used to hide the ark and other treasures and at the time of the Babylonian invasion. And then you have this idea of when, during the second building of the temple, after it's been sacked, this legend called the Julian legend, which is Emperor Julian, who was the emperor after Constantine, who formed a plan to rebuild for the Jews. And essentially, while working on the foundation, they find this stone that becomes dislodged. And investigating further, they discover a cavern hewn into the rock. The workman's lowered, attached to a cord, and he gets down to the bottom and he finds, you know, it's obviously very dark, but he feels water halfway up to his leg. He kind of crawls around and explores. He comes upon a column, and on the column is a book wrapped in fine linen. He brings the book, and the book essentially says the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then after discovering this book, these terrible flames come out of this place, and it's made inaccessible. And then you have the Philostorgias, or I just butchered that, legend, which is similar, exactly similar to the Julian legend, except for one difference, which is that the cavern's found to be perfectly square. And then you have the Callistus legend, who talks about essentially it's a merging of the Julian and the other legend, but the Romans aren't involved in it. This is essentially where the Jews are rebuilding the temple, and there's an earthquake, and the earthquake shakes loose some of the stones of foundation, and then they discover this vault holding this book or this treasure, if you will. And then, of course, then you have the modern, what I guess I call the Templar legend. The Templars during the Crusades were, you know, digging underneath Temple Mound and found something. So you have this idea of Solomon having a vault, and depending on what legend or what, you know, yeah, legend, I guess is the best term, what legend you follow, either this vault was originally Enoch's vault, or it's one that he specifically designed to hold the ark and or treasure underneath his temple.
I watched a series just recently that explored the idea that what if we were to gain access to Temple Mount. In the Temple Mount, of course, we all know this is a very, very holy site for a number of individuals, in particular of the Muslim faith. And there is a stone that is there, this giant rock, the one that is said to have been where Muhammad ascends to heaven. And I saw some interesting footage that I think somebody did some guerrilla photography, basically went in there when they visited and they took video. And it appears that there is a sort of cavern or something beneath these stones. And there's this legend of types of howling winds that come up from this. But there's just nothing that can be done, right? Because it is just like off limits, because it is the holy place. It's a holy place. And then, of course, I watch these archaeologists who explore the Western Wall, and they dig alongside of it, and they say, well, just on the other side of this would be under the Temple Mount, but we are not allowed to drill there or to go through for the same reasons. And it gives a lot of, you know, I don't like romanticized, I don't know how to put it. You know, it's just like the treasure hunt. The answers could all be there. It's as if, I don't know if you remember when they did the seismographs and they did the ground penetrating radar, the GPR, in front of the paws of the Sphinx, and they said that they did find a chamber there.
Right.
Right. But nobody's allowed to dig there because Zahi Hawass says no. Well, and everybody's like, what's Zahi? What's he hiding? Very interesting stuff. With this whole thing, we see a lot of parallels to these stories, right? We've got the whole Oak Island thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, in pop culture today, there's these kinds of stories of a hidden thing, a hidden treasure, you know, and even going back to something like, you know, the old 3D McKenna's Gold, right? If you ever watched that, a great Western, McKenna's Gold,
right?
Like they're on the search for kind of an El Dorado thing and they find it. And even when they get there, they can't take it. They have to escape because it's all crumbling around them. But we see this same kind of thing over and over, and it's like kind of embedded into our imaginations. And director and writer after director and writer seem to bring these things forward. I mean, you brought up, when we talked about this before, a couple of films that kind of mimic this. You want to talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, so, I mean, in my humble opinion, the Raiders of the Lost Ark is a retelling of you know, this sort of myth, the idea of a underground vault holds the Ark of the Covenant. Indy finds this in, I forget the, geez, I've seen the movie a million times. I can't remember the name of the Egyptian city that he finds it in, but essentially there's this, where you see Indy lowered on a rope into this vault. There's the big famous scene with all the snakes, and he drops down, and that King Cobra shoots up to confront him, and then he gets Hala down there, and Sala, and they find the Ark, only, you know, then to have it stolen by Balak. But you see it retold in that. You see it retold in National Treasure. National Treasure, essentially telling of the similar tale. There's this idea of this treasure that's buried underground that, in this particular case, that the Templars found, and then the Templars became Freemasons, and the knowledge was passed down through the Masons to the and given, embedded in these clues left by our Masonic founding fathers, most famously on the back of Declaration of Independence. So you have, you know, you just kind of have these ideas that penetrate popular culture surrounding the vault. And also, sonically, most of, I think, the cryptic degrees are centered around this idea of an underground vault as well. So very prolific, and more prolific, I'd say, in the York Rite than it is in either of the jurisdictions of the Scottish Rite.
Yeah, and as you started talking about the films, you think about this kind of lost treasure thing. They did the same sort of storyline with lost treasures being rediscovered. I think even in a couple episodes of Stargate SG-1, they did it in Atlantis. They continually, there's this thing, the search for the riches, right? And the second you go to remove these things, just like in that first tale you said, like the flame shoots out and it makes the passage unnavigable afterwards. Well, it's like in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade when he said you can't take the cup beyond the Great Seal. And what happens? It was interesting also to kind of note a more ancient aliens type of scenario with treasures and things. In the last Indiana Jones movie that was made, right, the aliens collected it all.
Right.
And they had this big archive. I mean, maybe they did. I don't know. That is, I don't care what anybody says. I really like that movie. And I think if they could do a recut and they just cut out the weird Shia LaBeouf swinging from the vines. That whole thing is very like Tarzan Disney.
The pitfall reenact from there.
Yeah, like if you just cut that out, it's an awesome movie, like top tier. And I'll argue that. So no hate mail from y'all. But what does it all mean, Darren? How is it connected? And what do you think the actual implication of that is? Do you think it's like, do you have some great revelation about it? Or is the revelation simply that, I mean, on the surface, you can just say that this is a tale of imagination that is a fascination, but maybe it dives into something deeper. Maybe it's talking about something on, like, it, you know, as it regards to people, like a search for the treasure in you, right? And by going about it the wrong way, you can destroy it. Or what are your thoughts around this?
So I tend to think a few things. I think that all of these tales you have to take as allegory, that you have to look at them in the historical context and say to yourself, look, this is a fantastic tale. I'd love for it to be true, but I think is more trending towards, as you said, teaching one some lessons. And I think what I personally believe is I think that this idea of Enoch kind of later became this idea of Solomon, that you have these similarities between Enoch and Solomon, and you have these differences. But if you look at them, and especially in the rabbinical legends where you talk about Solomon's command and conjuring of demons, you know, one could argue that what are demons but fallen angels? And you know, the idea of Enoch having
Think about this, right? There's not, I mean, of course, there's the Book of Solomonic Magic, but some of the highest grade of magic that exists in the occult world today is what we call Enochian magic.
Right. Yeah. And that was, you know, based upon John Dee's belief that he had discovered the Enochian language, which was the language that would be used to communicate with angels. And that then, you know, goes back to this idea of Enoch being, Metatron, or being able to, you know, communicate with the angels or communicate language to the angels. So what I think essentially we have these as, and we do it in our own society as well. You know, look at how many remakes are being made by Hollywood right now. These ideas of these movies that for, you know, when I was in the early throughout the 80s, you know, I turned 7 in 1980, and then I would have been, you know, 17 in 1990. So those were, you know, my formative years, and a lot of Gen Xers and millennials formative years were the 80s and 90s. So you see this reboot of, you know, all of these stories being retold. And I think you kind of had the same idea with Enoch here, and you have this idea of these pillars of Enoch being recycled for the tale of Solomon and Solomon's temple. And I hope to be proven wrong sometime, but, you know, let's face it, there's not a lot of historical evidence for either, you know, a historical King David or King Solomon that has been found. So, I mean, there are bits and pieces here and there, but it's not like you would think that even if, and I understand that this Temple Mount has been rebuilt and conquered by various people, but look at, as we talked prior to the episode, look at the ruins that you find of these temples in Egypt, you know, these massive structures, these massive edifices, and you don't have one block, one stone that can be attributed to Solomon's temple. But yet you have, you know, you go across the border to Egypt and you find all of these ruins. So I think what the tale of Enoch does is it is like, you know, as you said, this legend that, was either a person that became an amalgamation of previous maybe mythological figures, or there was a person known as Enoch that was a pretty wise man for his time, and wise enough that somebody thought you know, that this story about him has been passed on generation through generation, and then he becomes this morph into kind of this think Solomon and the idea of Solomon's vault. And but I think essentially, you know, if you look at it from the point of view that you just, I think it really is a legend that is teaching us God exists deep within all of us, and that, you know, we have to, I guess, in a certain aspect, you know, what Enoch's vault was doing and what was protecting either the Ark of the Covenant, which is the physical representation of God to the Israelites, or the holy name of God, which was, I think, in Enoch's time, probably served the same purpose as the representation of the Ark. The Ark was kind of taken from Egyptian tradition and then transformed by the Hebrews to be the bearer of Yahweh or Jehovah. I think that it's just essentially is just that. It's a great story, great legend. I'd love to think that Enoch was a real person, and I'd love to think that Enoch is still around as Metatron. Maybe I'll have a prophetic dream tonight and he'll set me wrong in my ways, but I just think that essentially there probably was a guy named Enoch. He's probably a righteous dude and maybe had some insight that others didn't have, and he was cool enough and memorable enough to be this, that we are still talking about him in the year 2022 when, you know, he lived.
I think this is all awesome. And I kind of want to be like Ron Wyatt, right? The guy who like is kind of when he was alive, he was a bit of a kook, right? He said he discovered the Ark of the Covenant and he found the Ten Commandments, and he even has his own museum, and it's usually closed unless you make it's by appointment, usually because they're out doing speaking tours and things about the museum. But a part of me wants to say, what if we could find the pillar that said where the vault was? You know, like, what if, right? Somebody out there, right? Make this movie. It'll be just so fun. Get Nicolas Cage. He'll do it. But man, it's such a fascinating concept. And then I always look at this idea of, you know, okay, so first of all, there's probably a lot of people who cringed when you said there's not a lot of historical evidence for Solomon and David. And this is really true. So I don't want anybody to get mad or anything, but there are a number of books out that have done this research, and something within the Tale of Solomon is just, it's wrong. So it's got to be the time or something else, because at the time that this stuff can be historically placed, Solomon comes across as a tribal warlord at best. So it does make sense that perhaps the first temple as a tabernacle in the wilderness, as Moses would have had, perhaps that was the case. Maybe he erected the first tabernacle or something. He certainly didn't have the, if we look at the timeline and the historicity of it all, there's just not a lot of evidence to say that he could have had this large empire, certainly not one large enough to construct what the first temple may have looked like. And that's not to say that the first temple didn't exist. Perhaps it did, but likely was built by this later on. And maybe we have the Western Wall of what we call the second temple. Maybe the second temple, I think Darren and I were talking, and I think you said maybe the second temple is the first temple.
Right.
You know, we don't know. Of course, we have faith that these things are true. I did read that there was a conch shell that was discovered and dated to the time of the first temple, and they believe it was used to sound the time for some kind of calling on the temple. But it's really between that and then that pomegranate that I think a lot of people have seen that dates to the time of Solomon, but it's not necessarily the key to unlocking everything as factual. Certainly, I would hope it's all awesome, and it would be great if it was true. But archaeology and geology hopefully will yield us some answers in the future and make us feel and get all warm and fuzzy about it. I think this whole thing is very fascinating. So one of the things, if we could kind of just backtrack for a quick moment, is that these pillars are supposed to have been cast and carved And we heard a lecture recently in my lodge by worship brother Patrick Day, and he talked about the pillars. And essentially, he said they would have had to have been hollow because bronze pillars that would have been solid would have been just insanely heavy. So they would have had to have been hollow. And so I thought that was interesting, but it got me thinking again about this idea of pillars that were made by Enoch and then again by Hiram as the craftsman of Solomon's temple. When we think about this, just like in your opinion, surface level, are there two sets of pillars? One inspired by the other? Or is the character of Enoch, is this more evidence to what you were saying, that maybe Enoch is an amalgamation of sorts or an earlier version of the Solomonic character or even Hiram?
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess if you want to look at the Hiramic legend that at face value, when Hiram is raised and Enoch was essentially raised up to the heavens and taken, are we retelling kind of a legend of Enoch in the third degree? Maybe. I think that there are a few things that fascinate me about Enoch and the connection to Freemasonry. That the first is that the Book of Enoch wasn't really recovered until the late 17th century, but you have James Anderson talking about Enoch as being a primary figure to Freemasonry in the Constitution of 1723. You have knowledge of Enoch by Anderson and I'm sure others at the foundation of modern Freemasonry, considering 1717 was the formation of the first Grand Lodge of England. But you also, I think, have this rabbinical legend as well, this idea these pillars were maybe discovered by Solomon and that gave him the location of the Vault of Enoch, and then he used the location of the vault to mark where he was going to build his temples. I would say that if asked if there were two sets or just one set, I tend to think that it would probably be the one set versus the two, even though, you know, we're taught in the Fellowcraft degree about Hiram Abi or Hiram Abo, the widow's son from the tribe of Naphtali, you know, casting these things. I tend to think that, at least I think the story's a lot neater if these are the original pillars of Enoch that we have represented in every lodge and, at least in the United States.
I'm not going to do any better. I'm going to let you have that final word because I think that is something that is really cool to think that we've got something so mystical as that perhaps portrayed in the lodge. I mean, in the Golden Dawn, we've got, I shouldn't say we, I'm not in the Golden Dawn.
Right, but they've got the same, and in fact, they do a better representation of the Golden Dawn because I believe you have at least one of the pillars does have hieroglyphics on it, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, both pillars with hieroglyphs, one black, one white.
That's right. That's right.
This is very interesting. Well, Darren, I want to thank you for coming on. This was an awesome, enlightening conversation about the pillars and Enoch and Solomon and the historical accounts of things and the mythologies. I hope the people out there that are watching definitely tune in to Meet Acton Park. Check out what Darren writes on the Midnight Freemasons. He is essentially the managing editor. You know, he says that like it started as a co-managing editor, but he's doing it all now and he does a fantastic job. And I want to thank you for continuing to make that a priority for all of us and for doing your podcast.
Thanks for the words of encouragement, Robert. You know, we, I think, lift each other up. So we'll just keep on doing that. And a pleasure being on here.
So I'm hoping that in the future we'll get to read something maybe a little bit more like laid out linear so that we can have some awesome lodge education on this. I know I'm going to be digging back into this because you've rekindled my interest on it. And hopefully,
I do give a presentation on this. So if any of the brothers out there want to hear the presentation, you can reach me either through Robert or my email's on midnightfreemasons.org. So,
well, I think I've also got you on masonicinstruction.com/Darren.
Yes, I believe so.
So if you head over there, you can actually fill out a little form and it'll send them an email as a request to be a speaker. And Darren, as far as his travel arrangements and things, I think it's essentially that you take care of the travel or, you know, I think you can do virtual stuff too. But I'll have all that in the show notes for you.
And Darren, thank you again so much.
Thanks for having me again, Robert. We'll talk to you soon.
Well, there you have this rad conversation. All the things that we talked about, for the most part, are going to have links in the show notes. I hope you guys check that out. Please check out his podcast, Meet, Act, and Part. If you want to listen about more weird and crazy stuff, feel free to check out Beyond the Fourth Veil, a podcast on all things weird and high strangeness, as well as any number of other things that we're involved in. And again, I really thank you all for checking those things out. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners for everything that they do to bring the Whence Came You podcast to everyone and to anyone who is interested in the royal art and its kindred sciences. If you want to learn more about how you can assist the WCY podcast in producing quality Masonic education that you could trust, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. We've got a number of different options there, and every little bit helps, and everything goes right back into this podcast and the promotion of Masonic education. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining me one more time. I want to thank my guest, Brother Darren Lehners, worshipful Brother Darren Lehners, a constant force for good and a great inspiration to us all. Thank you so much, brother, for finding the time to do this with us. And I look forward to talking to him real soon. I think I owe him a couple projects, so I got to get those underway. Anyway, that's it for this week. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
Yeah.